It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Ercher-Kent. We examine potential solutions to urgent economic problems that might be applied in Wisconsin and elsewhere. These initiatives underway in different parts of the world, they aim to help close the wealth gap, they aim to address the climate crisis, and create meaningful jobs along the way. You can be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question, share your thoughts at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Romeo covers policy and ideas for The New Yorker, teaches in the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. His book is called The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy. Nick, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, you write about how economists and leaders take the structure of the economy as set in stone. But you argue that it can be organized in many ways. Why has thinking about the economy become so rigid?
Sure. You know, the first chapter of the book, I get into some of that history, and I also get into some of the really battles that are raging in the present over how to teach economics to undergraduates, to graduate students. But a short answer has to do with the kind of false analogy of economics to physics, where there are supposedly natural laws that govern the economy and that are unalterable. It turns out that a lot of times when people think in this way, those natural laws are very, very beneficial to the status quo and they prevent meaningful change. So that's a kind of target of critique for people trying to reform economics education, is to get rid of that way of thinking and to have a more kind of nuanced and empirical approach. Because if you just look at how economies have changed, you'll quickly see that many of these so-called laws are nothing of the sort.
You have also said that economists thinking themselves as scientists is undemocratic. Can you go into that a little bit?
Well, you know, in this first chapter, I'm really quoting many economists themselves. The scientist label is an interesting one. It seems like people in the field are a little bit split on that. Some will say social scientist, so there's that modifier there before scientist. Others will just reject the term entirely, and there are still a few who cling to it as well. I think the connection to democracy is that, you know, if your view is that economists have a kind of very particular access to knowledge about how we should set up our economy and that they alone have that, it's a little bit hard to see why ordinary people should have much input, right? So there is some tension between seeing economists as the kind of reigning high priests who should have total control because of their scientific knowledge and seeing sort of these decisions being made in a much more democratic way where everyone should have some input over how we're doing, you know, everything from wages to the structure of labor markets, to decisions about distribution, taxation, and very consequential decisions about climate policy.
You also reach far back to philosophers and novelists like Plato and Tolstoy. Why look to them for economic insights instead of like the economists of today?
Well, you know, many of the economists today are sort of rediscovering points that were originally made in the works of novelists and philosophers. So some of the more educated economists realize that, which is great. You know, I quote Sam Bowles, for instance, who's a wonderful economist. At the end of his book on game theory, he acknowledges that much of what he's been saying is kind of a rediscovery of Aristotle. So, yeah, you know, I think Plato, Tolstoy, a lot of these thinkers have very deep insights into questions that are economic, that have to do with how resources are distributed, but also how they should be distributed. And notice there's a kind of dual purpose there to their inquiry. They want to know how things do work, but they also ask the question of how they should work.
Yes. Talking about the economy with Nick Romeo, author of The Alternative, you can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. You introduce us to true pricing, and you explore what people pay for products and the true price paid for making those items. What do you mean by the true price?
Yeah, true pricing is quite interesting. It's a movement that has really taken off in the Netherlands, although there's interest around Europe, and there are also some American think tanks and institutions that use the methodology. So basically, an easy way to think of it is that, currently when we go into a grocery store, we pick up a product, we have a patchwork of different labels, each of which gives us some visibility into the conditions along that supply chain. So, for instance, if you buy something that's organic, let's take the classic example of an apple, you get your organic apple. The word organic, it does have some legally enforceable meaning. So you do know certain things because of that label. So then let's say your apple is also local. Okay, that maybe there's a bit of wiggle room there, but you at least know that it wasn't flown halfway around the world. And so you have some insight into, let's say, the carbon footprint. You still might not know anything about the working conditions of the people who grew and picked and transported your apple. Even with labels like fair trade, which do cover some of those labor conditions, it's very partial and you don't have a lot of visibility. So a true price, it takes all of these different elements and it says, what if we could actually combine all of these and put the information in those into the price signal itself? So economics refers to the cost of transactions that are not included in a price as externalities. So this could be an impact on the environment, but it could be the fact that maybe the community in which wages are very low starts to have all sorts of problems. It could be a kind of human rights issue as well.
So
So if
this,
you have a, you'll go ahead,
I was
yeah.
going to say, so this grocery store in Amsterdam attempts to account for these types of costs and offers shoppers the choice of whether to pay them or not. Can you talk about what happened in the grocery store and what impact it's had on shoppers?
Well, surprisingly, at least to the owner, the business in the store improved after they rolled out true pricing for products. That, at first people were confused and they wanted to understand why they were paying more. But once they understood that the previous cheapness of prices was kind of an illusion, and that by not paying them, it's not that those prices went away, it's just that other people paid them, often people who were quite vulnerable far away. So people were happy to pay those higher prices, at least in this store in Amsterdam. And then some of that extra money generated by the true price surplus is used to help remediate some of those issues that I described, whether those are environmental or kind of labor and human impacts.
But you, I think you also said it's difficult to be able to trace that money back to the source of where those where those disparities are occurring. Is that a downfall of true pricing?
It's a challenge for sure. Yeah, it's currently not highly precise in the targeting. So, you may not know exactly which chocolate came from which farm. And so, if you generate a surplus through true pricing, it can be hard to know exactly how to trace that money back to the growers and producers. But that's really only speaking from the vantage point of this one grocery store. If you think from a broader perspective, companies can use true pricing as well. And I talk about a European chocolate company that uses true pricing to audit its own supply chains. And so they know exactly where these disparities are within their supply chain and can remediate it very precisely. Governments and policymakers can also use true pricing as a tool, and they can have some of that more fine-grained information often.
Journalist and author Nick Romeo with us. New book that gives this roadmap for a sustainable and just economy with solutions to address wealth inequality and the climate crisis. Call in with a question, add comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new book asks the question, what unrealized ideas could help the greater world survive and flourish in these times? And we wonder what economic initiatives could Wisconsin replicate from other parts of the world that could create a sustainable future? Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Romeo's new book is called The Alternative. Nick, let's turn to minimum wage. When policymakers or economists refer to living wages, they generally mean the minimum amount of money that someone needs to cover the cost of living. You found that actually calculating a living wage is complicated and subjective. Why is it so difficult?
You know, this was a really interesting chapter for me to research and report. The term living wage first really takes off in America just over 100 years ago, and figures like Teddy Roosevelt had a very generous, capacious understanding of what living meant, at least relative to how it's often understood today. So things like savings for retirement, money for childcare, a little bit of money for a rainy day, an unexpected life event, even a short vacation, all of this was part of Roosevelt's understanding of living. Now, fast forward to today, and those elements have been stripped away. We have a much, much less generous conception of living. And so whenever someone talks about a living wage, I think the first thing to do is to get very clear on which elements they're including and which they're excluding. And this is, as you can probably imagine, not something that economists alone should answer. It's really a more political, ethical, and democratic discussion to be had.
And you introduce us to the MIT living wage calculator. Can you explain what that calculator is doing with trying to create living or trying to basically figure out what a living wage means in different parts of the country?
Yeah, so the MIT living wage calculator has lots and lots of data on the county and state levels about different elements of the costs of living, so things like groceries, rent, etc., all around the country. So in one sense, it's very useful, and it has been used by both employees and employers to figure out, you know, in my neck of the woods, the Bay Area, versus your neck of the woods, what does it actually cost to live? What if you have one kid? What if you have two kids? What if you have one family? What if you have two? You can input all of this into the calculator and it spits out an answer. The way in which it's less helpful is that some of the definition of living that it uses is kind of buried within the technical documentation for the calculator. And if you dig into it a little bit, it turns out that all of those Roosevelt elements that I mentioned have really been stripped away. And so it's a very constricted sense of living. The economist at MIT who runs that calculator told me that she regularly gets emails from people all around the country saying, I can't live on what you're calling a living wage. So in some sense, it's a deeply misleading term. And in, you know, many people feel like I'm not actually living, I'm just sort of barely not dying.
And yet companies use this calculator to inform what they will pay their workers.
That's right. It's very widely used. It's very influential, both in policy circles and in the for-profit sector. So I think it's desperately in need of a dramatic overhaul. And I think a much more generous conception of living would really enable that term to be accurately understood. So that if you say, I earn a living wage, I think most people think, oh, you know, that's kind of a decent middle-class lifestyle. Maybe you get to go out to a restaurant sometimes, you take a little vacation. Turns out that's very far from true.
Opponents of raising the minimum wage say businesses would lay off workers and inflation would grow. That would hurt low-income, low-wage workers the most. What do researchers know about minimum wage hikes?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, in the last few decades, the consensus has changed. Two economists won a Nobel Prize for a famous paper and actually a whole body of research comparing areas in which the minimum wage was raised to areas in which it was not. So they found these kind of natural experiments in which you could look at two otherwise similar regions in which only one of the two regions had raised the minimum wage. And the orthodoxy, the kind of expectation was that, oh yeah, of course, if you raise minimum wages, there are going to be huge, huge impacts on unemployment. Because just as you said, businesses will have to close. So it turns out those effects have been dramatically overstated. That's often simply not the case. Now, to be fair, if you think about raising to living wages and to a sort of generous definition of living, there could very well be effects on unemployment. And, you know, the Catholic priest in the early 20th century who defined the term in America and wrote a book about it, I like his thinking on this matter because he kind of redefines what we even mean by a successful business. And he says sort of that a successful business is one that can pay its workers well. That's kind of just part of the cost of doing business. You don't succeed by paying your workers so that they can live very limited, miserable, marginal lives where they're constantly struggling. That's just a misunderstanding of the term success. So I think there's a cultural piece here too that would need to shift.
We discussed the economy with Nick Romeo, who covers policy and ideas at The New Yorker, teaches at the University of California, Berkeley. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Nick, in November, the president of the Wisconsin State Senate appeared on our program and opposed raising the minimum wage. Here's Republican State Senator Chris Kapinga.
We've got people, entry-level college kids, who we come in and do internships at my business, and you know, we offered $15 an hour, and they tell me I can go to Quick Trip and work part time for $17 an hour. So the reality is, the minimum wage, there's not a job out there that's paying that low right now.
Wisconsin having the federal minimum wage, are market forces making it unnecessary for elected officials to raise the minimum wage?
No, I don't think that's the case. You know, it's easy to sort of cherry pick one or two examples, but if you look at the struggles of people all around the country, there are so many folks who are struggling to afford housing, food, childcare. All of these costs have increased in the last few years. And so I think it's misleading to suggest that market forces are kind of naturally taking care of folks. There's just far too much struggle among low-wage workers for that to be the case.
You talked to the owner of Well-Paid Maids, this D.C.-based company that pays workers a starting salary that is double the median wage of maids. What does this example illustrate?
Yeah, so this is a fascinating business. It was started by a millennial in D.C., a guy named Aaron Sayedian, and he launched the business explicitly as an intervention into debates about wage setting. You know, he wanted to show that you could be a successful business while still paying people decently. And he has really succeeded in that goal. He has grown year on year enormously, is expanding to other cities along the East Coast. He pays well above even the MIT definition, which is, as we talked about, pretty minimal. So his sense of a living wage is very capacious. He promotes from within, so you'll have people who started as cleaners who move up to operations managers. And, you know, at that point, they could be making $60,000, $70,000. So it's a nice kind of proof of concept for businesses succeeding while paying workers quite well.
Let's bring on Bill in Wausau now. Bill, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for the program. I'm enjoying it. My question is there anybody calculating how much of the cost of a particular product goes to CEOs, to corporate costs, to shareholders, compared to how much of each product's cost is allocated to workers, producers, salespeople, transport, and things like that? I think that would be a useful breakdown to help us make consumer decisions and political decisions.
Bill, thank you. Nick, go ahead.
Bill, I totally agree with you. I think that's a really good suggestion. My understanding is that the folks at True Price, they do sometimes use the tool in a customizable way. So it would really just be tweaking some of the parameters. If you could get that information through, you know, SEC filings or the European equivalent of those kinds of filings for publicly traded companies, you could say, look, here's the pay ratio of highest to lowest paid worker. We're going to factor that into the true price. What if that ratio were cut in half? How would that change? I think that's a wonderful idea.
We have journalist and author Nick Romeo's new book. It's called The Alternative, exploring some of the world's unique economic and policy ideas and what we could learn from them in Wisconsin and elsewhere. You can be part of the discussion. Email ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new book argues that a combination of public and private sector initiatives can improve the world by creating a more just economy. We explore examples across the globe that seek to help develop fair and sustainable economies and what frameworks that Wisconsin might consider. You can be part of the conversation, call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234. Nick Romeo's book is called The Alternative. Let's go to Daryl in Menominee Falls. Daryl, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Well, I'd like to bring up the my interpretation of the way the economy is not balanced toward the worker these days. 30, 40 years ago, we had companies where the husband could go to work and earn enough money and the wife could stay home. Not to say that that's what would work in this modern economy with women's rights, which they should be entitled to be paid well as men. But the fact, I think, is that they're just more the profits of the companies are going to the CEOs and the owners of companies, which I think is fair, but I think that more of that money could be transitioned to the workers' wages, where they could live in a more sustainable economy and pay bills without struggling.
Daryl,
I think there should be more of a balance there.
Daryl, thank you for bringing up that balance. Nick, what are the ratios did you encounter between CEOs and rank-and-file workers?
You know, the latest data in America is pretty extraordinary. It's around 350, so that's 350 to 1. This is really an anomalous figure if you zoom out. And by zoom out, I mean both look around the world, but also look back in time, even in America. So one of the chapters in the book focuses on a network of worker-owned cooperatives in northern Spain. All of these businesses, and some of them do enormous industrial manufacturing of things like jet engines and elevators, all of these businesses have a pay ratio cap of 6 to 1. Hmm. So that, you know, is just an extraordinary difference, 6 to 1 versus 350 to 1. Now, the kind of standard prediction would be if you pay executives so little, you're not going to be able to recruit top talent, and so your business will suffer and eventually disappear. On the contrary, the Mondragon cooperatives in Spain are enormously successful. They compete for contracts around the globe. They have over 80,000 workers. So it's a really robust model that, at least for that part of Spain, has had tremendous success. And I can talk about other examples in the States and elsewhere where that ratio is more compressed, if that would be useful.
And it was so interesting, though, with Mondragon that, you know, like the people in the cooperatives, they voted democratically on the ratio between the highest and lowest worker in terms of pay. I mean, it's so interesting to see the difference between, you know, the corporate world here and what is happening, what you are able to write about, what's happening in Mondragon Corporation.
Absolutely. And, you know, that brings us back to this question of democracy again. If you give people a vote on the question of executive compensation, it turns out that current ratios are not very popular. There's some interesting international research that I dig into a little bit in that chapter, where researchers interviewed people in countries around the world, and they asked two questions. The first question is, what do you think executive to worker pay is? The second question, what do you think it should be? Now, there was some variation between countries, but a general consensus emerged, and there was a pattern to how people answered both of those questions. So on the first question, people tended to think that ratios were much, much lower than in fact they are. So they would say, you know, I would guess it's 30 to 1, when in fact it might be 300 to 1 in a particular country. So they think that the world is less unequal than it actually is. Move on to that second question, what do you think it should be? People's answers compressed even further. Around the world, there was variation, but a typical answer was right around 7 to 1. So Mondragon is actually a place where what people think should exist more or less does.
Allison in Racine called in to ask if you had researched the impact of unions and the ability to increase living wages for their members.
Yes, unions, I think, are a vital tool. I do talk about unions in my living wage chapter, and I think, you know, collective bargaining throughout American history has been very important. The legal landscape has become much more challenging. There have been many laws that make it harder to unionize, where you have to unionize each workplace. So, you know, that's an unfortunate development, and that hurts workers' wages. But absolutely, unions are a vital part of making wages truly livable.
You also explore this idea of guaranteed jobs, and the state of Lower Austria created this pilot program that gave a job to anyone who had been unemployed for a year. What effects did this have?
So the job guarantee in Austria is a really interesting experiment. It's a kind of policy intervention where instead of just spending money on unemployment, the employment service over there said, what if we gave people work? Now, only people who want to work have to. It's important to distinguish this from something like workfare, where you're compelled back into the private labor market. So you're given the option to remain on unemployment, but if you'd prefer to go and work at a job, you can do that. And the types of jobs are a co-creation of the person looking for jobs and a social worker who understands some of the needs in the community. So they're co-designed such that people find them interesting and meaningful, but they also are intended to fulfill some sort of need that the community has. What was interesting, I mean, one thing I found really interesting is that everyone who was given the option to join the job guarantee wanted to. You might think people would say, oh no, I'll just keep receiving unemployment. I don't want to work. Why would I choose to work when I could do nothing and just receive the money? On the contrary, everyone wanted to participate. And I think the fact that they could co-design their jobs was a big part of that. But another part of it was that, you know, work really does provide people with more than just money. It gives you colleagues and a social network. It can have positive impacts on your self-esteem. It can give you a way to structure your time every day. So all of these kind of psychological and social benefits are also being studied by some of the economists and sociologists who are watching this experiment in Austria.
And it's fascinating. You found that it's no more costly than what the state already spends on its unemployment program. Is that right?
That is right. Yeah, that was an important design feature of the job guarantee. And you can kind of see how that would preempt the objection that, oh, we can't afford this, it's too much money. On the contrary, they're spending that money anyway. So why not do something that has some of these social and psychological benefits for the people participating, but that also can meet some needs in the community?
We're talking with Nick Romeo, author of The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy. Call in with your questions or thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. Nick, what do researchers think would happen if the United States government created a national job guarantee program? What might happen here?
So there's an economist that I cite in this chapter who has done some modeling of that, and it's actually surprisingly feasible and affordable. It's also quite popular in polling with Americans to have a federal job guarantee. You know, I think a few things could happen if that were instituted in the states at a federal level. And, you know, to a lesser extent, I think this could also happen at a state level, which might be more realistic given the political environment here. But one of the things that would happen would be upward pressure on private sector employers. If every worker in America knew that they had a solid option for the public sector job guarantee, private sector employers would have to compete more. They'd have to compete on the quality of their work, the meaning, the conditions, but also on the quantity of wages. So that pressure would improve private sector conditions too. You simply couldn't get away with some of the behaviors that a lot of the low road employers in America currently do. You know, I think another thing that could happen with a federal job guarantee is that you could mobilize an enormous number of people to tackle really essential societal needs, whether that's care work for young and old people in America, which the private market currently fails pretty atrociously in those areas, or whether that's sort of infrastructure refurbishing, green transition work. There's no shortage of work that needs doing and that the private sector is either not doing or doing too slowly. So I think it could have a lot of wide-ranging effects.
How might a program like this affect the gig economy and the marketplace of part-time work?
Well, a job guarantee would be an interesting candidate for gig economy to interface with, because I mean, I think one thing that would have to be sort of worked out with a job guarantee is the question of part-time or flexible work. Like if you only have 20 hours a week, maybe because you're caring for young people, maybe because you have a medical condition and that's sort of your upper limit, how can a job guarantee accommodate you? Now, I know from the Austria example that flexibility is kind of built into their design. So there are people there who are working 15 hours. There are people who are working closer to 40 hours. So if you had that sort of flexibility, it's still maybe a question of whether you could use a job guarantee to start to compete with services like Lyft, Uber, DoorDash. I have a separate chapter in the book that actually pretty explicitly would be a public sector option for gig work. But I think a job guarantee could at least be one way of helping to put some pressure on those companies just by giving people another option.
Nick Romeo covers policy and ideas at The New Yorker. The book is called The Alternative, examining different visions for how to build an equitable economy. Call in with a question. Bring your thoughts to the discussion at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with journalist Nick Romeo about how governments across the globe are implementing creative and practical solutions to urgent economic problems and making progress on closing inequalities. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. The book is called The Alternative. Nick, you write about a movement involving the Democracy Collaborative and private equity funds to buy up companies and turn them into worker-owned cooperatives. How does this process work?
So the basic idea is that there are lots of businesses around America, many of them owned by baby boomers, but not all, that are going to transition within the next decade. What if each of those businesses were converted into a worker-owned co-op? So instead of selling a business to private equity or a strategic buyer, these funds, they accumulate institutional capital. Then they take that capital to offer competitive sale prices to retiring business owners. So the business owner still gets some benefit. Then the fund owns the business, converts it into a worker ownership model. And then over time, workers sort of gain equity. So they pay back the fund. The fund gets some return on investment. So it's this kind of triple win, if you will. The workers benefit, the capital owners, the investment people, they get some money. And then the retiring business owner also gets a nice retirement. All of it's in the service of decreasing wealth inequality. Worker ownership models compress some of those pay ratios that we were talking about earlier.
How significant is the current model, the current dominance of private equity in buyouts and owners exiting their companies?
Well, it's important to stress that this model that I'm describing is not the default mode of operation for private equity. So I think in the last year, this actually might be for 2022, there were something like 4,000 private equity deals, and there were only 400 ESOPs created. ESOP mm-hmm. stands for Employee Stock Ownership Plan. So that's, as the name suggests, a shared ownership model. That ratio, these are ballpark figures, but the 10-to-1 ratio there of 4,000 to 400 gives you a sense of the scale. And it shows that worker ownership is still not as widespread or mainstream as perhaps it should be.
So if a larger portion of American companies were worker owned, what effects would this have on the economy at large?
Well, one statistic that I really have been struck by in the book is if you imagine the level of worker ownership at Sears department stores in the 1950s in America, and then you apply that same level of worker ownership to Amazon workers in 2018, every Amazon worker would have roughly $380,000 of equity. Now that's from 2018. Amazon stock has more than doubled since then. So we'd be talking about closer to $1 million of equity. And this would be for people who deliver packages, stock shelves at warehouses. And this is just for Amazon. Now imagine that model spreading to 100 largest employers in America. I think you can see that pretty quickly you'd get to a robust and flourishing middle class. So worker ownership, it's hard to overstate the potential it has to combat wealth inequality in the country.
Let's bring in Marty in Elkhorn now. Marty, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. You know, if you were to take a spectrum, your guest's suggestion would be on one end about, I guess, in essence, making the worker, eventually the workers own the company. At the other end would be the trickle-down effect. And I believe that is a big cause of why workers are so ill-paid, because any profit that comes goes to the shareholders first. And then what's left over trickles down to the employees. And you know the shareholders are going to want a return on their investment. You know, the workers are always going to get short shrift. So that's my comment.
Marty,
thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, Marty, thank you. Nick, what do you make of that sentiment?
I largely agree. I mean, I think that shareholders and maybe especially some of their more aggressive representatives, they are very influential in pressuring companies to cost cut, which when it comes to wages for workers means depriving workers of income. And, you know, I think it's also reasonable to wonder about whether publicly traded companies are going to be open to using these kinds of shared ownership models. There are some examples of ESOPs at publicly traded companies. They're not super common, but the two structures are compatible. So I think there's hope there, but it's true that shareholders are not necessarily going to want some of the profits that they could be getting to go to workers. Now, on the other hand, there's an argument that workers work harder when they have some ownership stake in a company. As they say in business school, the incentives are aligned. So you feel like you own the company, you're going to work harder. So there is a conceivable win-win there, but I think it's also the case that sometimes it is more of a zero-sum dynamic where one loss is the other's gain.
I was thinking about here in Wisconsin how we have hundreds of co-ops, over 700 co-ops, according to the UW Center for Cooperatives. 240 of them are in the agriculture sector. What effect might farmer-led co-ops have on the broader Wisconsin economy? Any insights there?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think there are, people mean different things by co-ops, you know, so there are producer co-ops, consumer co-ops. When you have those statistics, do you know which type those apply to?
They were looking at all different sectors of the economy. 240 of them were in the agriculture sector. I mean, here we have like dairy co-ops, and I'm just wondering, when you talk about ESOPs, are they in the same category as what we might think here of co-ops, like in the dairy industry?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's at least a strong family resemblance. So worker-owned cooperatives are typically modeled on a kind of democratic one worker, one vote structure where the people at the workplace have some direct input over really important decision-making. I mean, sometimes this is called open book management, but you typically do see effects on wages and profit sharing when you give people voting power over how the business is run. So if the co-ops in Wisconsin follow these models where every worker is given input over wage setting, then I think there's absolutely a strong kind of shared ownership structure that's likely to result from that.
In our last moments together, is there one idea that you think could immediately make our economy more equitable?
Probably the worker ownership model that we've been describing. I think that's a kind of, I don't want to say quick fix, but it would have an immediate impact. If you have enormous amounts of value and profit that companies are generating, simply sharing more of that with the workers who help to create that profit and value, that immediately sort of pushes income and wealth back down the economic scale, compresses pay gaps, and also really diminishes people's sense of just unfairness and kind of anger over the current economy in which they work. So I think that if I had to choose one, that would probably be it.
Nick, thank you for joining us and for sharing your book with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Nick Romeo covers policy and ideas at The New Yorker, and his book is called The Alternative, How to Build a Just Economy. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.